Welcome to this week's episode of Safe Room, a horror video game podcast and proud member of Bloody Disgusting's Bloody FM podcast network. I'm your host, Jay Krieger.
And I'm the other one, Neil Bell.
And this week we're chatting about a topic that has never divided audiences or fandoms, that being adaptations of beloved game series for the silver and smaller screen. And what other series for us to focus on this month then? Craig Mazin and Neil Druckmann's The Last of Us series for HBO. Adapted from Naughty Dog's critically acclaimed game, The Last of Us, follows the plight of smuggler Joel Miller, who reluctantly agrees to escort a mysterious girl named Ellie across a post-outbreak America, which has been ravaged by a fungal infection that's turned people into zombie-like creatures. And joining us once again is GameSpot producer and Safe Room's official The Last of Us correspondent, Jake Decker. How's it going, Jake?
It's going good. Thank you guys for having me again. Always excited to talk about The Last of Us.
Yeah, I had you on my podcast, Daily Horror Habit, to chat about the premiere episode. Mm-hmm. And I think at that time, you know, we could only talk about the first episode, but you had seen a handful of them. And I'm really excited to, dive more into the season and whatnot and to see how, you know, some of the threads that were planted in that premiere episode, you know, flourished for the entire season and whatnot. We can talk about, obviously, some of the qualities of the adaptation that worked for us. I'm sure there might be one or two things that maybe didn't land for all of us as we thought they would, but I'm really excited to sort of pick both of your brains on the season.
Yeah, can't wait.
Start with the casting. I think, you know, when you have a game like The Last of Us, right, a game that is so drawn into these two people and really, you know, they are what elevate that very sort of, I would say, simplistic story, but it's one that is very much rooted in like deep emotions. I think for me, that was my hesitation, right? And probably all fans of the game, right, is while Pedro Pascal and Bella Ramsey are both, you know, accomplished actors in their own right, sometimes those sort of adaptations sort of miss the mark, right? Do they change too little? Do they rely too heavily on, you know, what has already been done before that? And so let's start with Pedro Pascal as Joel. You know, for you, Jake, how was Pedro Pascal in adapting? Did he, you know, stray too far from the source material, stray too close?
I loved him. I thought he was great. I thought he was a great Joel. He brought some new stuff to the character, but also didn't deviate too far. He also looked a lot like Joel, you know, like I know they don't always need to look alike, but for me, it kind of helped. And, you know, from time to time, I'd hear him talk and I'd be like, he sounds like Joel, but he doesn't sound too much like Joel. He's kind of got his own sort of style. So I was super impressed with Pedro. Anyway, there was a bunch of actors that people wanted. And if someone told me Pedro Pascal would have been it, I would have been like, I don't know about that. And up until release, I was kind of feeling that way. But yeah, after watching the series, he nailed it, knocked it out of the park.
How about you, Neil? How did you feel about Pedro being announced initially?
Yeah, from anything I'd ever seen him in, I could see where it might come from, you know, and where his sort of personality and acting style would work quite well with this character. And I think he's done enough here to sort of distance himself from the game character while still keeping those sort of same beats that are necessary to make him, you know, like Joel. I suppose the tough thing on that is that by expanding the character out more as they do and giving him a wider range of emotions, you know, it makes it a bit trickier to sort of go to those darker places. And obviously there are still parts of the fan base that don't quite understand that that's actually part of him and, you know, that he is not necessarily a good person and all that stuff. But, you know, I think that helped sell it more for me and helped make that character more of a real full-grown thing, you know, in that you could see him as most vulnerable. You could see why he would go to the lengths he would go to. It's not that he's just full-on sicko mode guy. He is just someone who is hurting so badly that the chance to redeem himself in his own head could take him anywhere, you know, and I like that. And it really, really did just get punctuated by the way Pedro Pascal sort of brought this character out. And one of the complaints you could make about the series is the amount of time they get together, but you still manage to get the beats just about there, you know, which I think is more credit to the acting than anything, I think, and how much they do with so little time together comparatively.
Yeah, that was my biggest worry with, you know, having a character like Joel that is so complicated and at the root of it, like, is not a good guy, which, you know, they make clear over the course of their journey together and unpacking a lot of, you know, the reasons for why he does the things that he does and how he's never truly, you know, gotten over that trauma of losing, you know, his daughter Sarah and whatnot, and of course just, you know, surviving in a essentially like a zombie apocalypse for 20 years, right? The things that he had to do to survive and whatnot, and to, you know, help out his brother and you know, Tess. But it is the type of thing where I was like, man, are they going to be able to take, because, you know, obviously storytelling in games and series is very different, right? With, in terms of the breakups between gameplay and then cutscenes, and you have these little bits of dialogue. But then when you have a series, right, and it's so heavily focused on Joel, I was really, really anxious about how they're going to navigate that. Yeah. Are they going to make him so over the top that, you know, I think that the game has a great balance between him being these smaller, softer elements to him that kind of show a semblance of his humanity before the outbreak. But then at the same time, you know, you see glimpses, of course, of what, of the person that he's become and what he's had to do to survive. And, you know, that is really a delicate balancing act, because when you have a series where every scene is basically with Joel, if you lean too far in one direction, it kind of throws off that character. And, you know, again, when you talk about characters that are so beloved, it's the type of thing where it's like, you don't want to alienate your audience right off the jump. No. But at the same time, if you take this drastic shift in the portrayal of a character also, it's kind of like, well, this is starting to deviate too far from that source material and from that character who is so strong. And also, you know, I think it took me probably two watches of the premiere and then up until the second episode before I was like really on board with the portrayals, because again, I had, you know, Troy Baker and Ashley Johnson in the back of my mind always, and just kind of being like, oh, is Pedro, you know, trying to do a Troy impression here? Is he trying to do his best impression of like a Southern accent or something like that? But there is this really nice balance, I think, between drawing some inspiration from those original roles or voice performances, but then at the same time, you know, using his own skill set as an actor. And it's something that I think it grew on me very quickly in a way that I was like, no, okay, these are proper portrayals in the sense that there's enough of the source material in them, but at the same time, they take these little deviations that, you know, are backed up by Craig Mazin and Neil Druckmann's writing that support that. How did you guys feel about Ellie? Because Bella Ramsey, you know, obviously another Game of Thrones alum, but I hadn't necessarily seen her in anything other than that. And to be honest, I haven't watched Game of Thrones in forever. How did you guys, Jake, how did you feel about her portrayal of Ellie, which I think takes a little longer maybe to really flourish than Joel's in the series?
Yeah, I was going to say, it definitely took me longer to get used to her as Ellie. Once again, I will say there were moments where she would sound a lot like the Ellie from the game, say very similar things. I mean, you know, a lot of people know that some scenes are just straight from the game, that, but you know, redone with those actors. So yeah, I would agree. I think it took me a little bit longer to get used to her. But once I did, I thought as well, I mean, she just did a great job capturing that character. And for a lot of the same reasons as Pedro Pascal and Joel, it was like, this is a character I'm very familiar with. This is the character I really like. And they managed to like, yes, tell the same story, but kind of give different shades of Ellie from a different perspective. And I thought it worked. I was watching an interview with her. And I forgot who, I think just like some press person was like, so did you play the game? Did you base your character off of her at all? And she was like, no, I'm a lot like her. Like I read the script and I was like, this seems like me. So I'm just going to play myself, cause I can't really overthink it. Cause then I'm going to be trying to do something that's not me. And I think it just like, it goes down to the casting directors, you know, like I know when that got announced, people were like, oh, that doesn't look like Ellie. Like, is that going to work? But you know, when it comes down to it, you know, looks are important, but you want someone who can embody that character. And I'd say they did. So yeah, I was, you know, I was satisfied by both of them. I thought they both did great.
Yeah. I think of the casting choices there when they came out, this was the one for me. I saw it and was like, makes sense. Really does. Having seen how she can be. I thought, yeah, you could, because straight away you're going to believe that she can be a foul mouthed little git, you know, and also just be likable with it, which is the two key things you want out there. And yeah, I do think, again, this is another one that sort of benefited from not taking too much of the games on themselves and just going for the character, because again, they flesh out so much more of her vulnerability and you know, why she is so spiky. And you get more of a sense of why they are essentially so similar and why they get will eventually get on, and why there's this sort of very sort of volcanic thing under the surface with them, you know, that will obviously eventually explode in its own way. So yeah, it's a really good performance, and better even my expectations were as high as they were for her to do that. She really did just blow you away. And for someone who hadn't played the game or had seen that performance, maybe even to come out at certain lines, even when it wasn't just like in-game lines, it was the delivery was uncanny. And it was just like, how can you not? I don't believe you haven't seen it even now, because it's like, it's just a bit too close like that. It's the mannerisms. But as you said, if the script calls for the right thing, I think got to give credit to Druckmann in that regard, because you go back to that original script, it's there. You know, there's someone who wasn't a teenager playing a teenager and still getting it, you know, and the same true here. You know, you've got someone who's just ending their teenage years, but still close enough to sort of understand these fundamentals of it. And it, yeah, it's just there in the character and the writing of that character. And with the right actor, as it shows, you can bring that out.
Yeah, you know, her nailing the Ellie cadence and just like sensibilities, I feel like it was so perfect. Like Jake said, like, sure, a lot of people at the time were like, and even myself, it was kind of like, well, you want to cast somebody that looks as close to the character as possible. But, you know, once you get to like episode two, right? And I think that one begins with her mimicking a clicker, right? When they're kind of like, oh, is she going to turn or not? And then it's kind of like a perfect moment that just kind of captures her sensibilities as a kid that's come up in the, you know, post-apocalypse and everything. And the fact that, you know, oh, you know, this is a person that we are viewing as cargo, but as soon as that sort of personality starts to bleed through, it's the type of thing where it's like, oh, okay, you can already see the shift in how they view her, right? And that's kind of like the very beginning of it, I think. And it was great to see that periodically just build and build and build to the degree that, you know, of course you inevitably get to like the puns and things like that. But what I really liked about it was that, and it was true of the game as well, but in the series, you have her periodically chiding Joel, right, about his perception of things in this world and whatnot, and specifically when it's tied to like the old world, right? I think it's at the beginning of episode three when they're walking through a field and they see like a crashed airplane, and he's like very, he's kind of like bitching about how flying was and everything, how expensive it was and all of these things. And then Ellie's like, dude, you got to go into the sky, which is such like a great moment that just like captures an adolescence that has basically been robbed for her, right? This idea that she'll never really know the old world, and marvels at elements of that, that people that were there at the time, like take for granted or took for granted, basically. And just little moments like that, I thought really helped to bring Ellie out of her, maybe much sooner than Joel for me. And something that, you know, I rewatched the season this last week, because, you know, I wanted to see what it was like to kind of just marathon through it without having to wait, you know, a week and whatnot, and kind of just consume it all at once. And something that I was cognizant of the first time, and definitely was the second time I watched it, was what I found to be a softer portrayal of Joel. And I'm of two minds of it. On one hand, I understand that you can't, like I said earlier, you can't have a character that is leaning so far into one of two camps that he kind of belongs to, right? It's either going to be really hardcore Joel that's been shaped by the apocalypse, who is this guy that's killed lots of people in these things, or you have this more heartfelt Joel. And, you know, for me, the show definitely picks and chooses when it leans a little too far into a softer portrayal of Joel. But then again, it's nine episodes long, right? You can't have a protagonist that within three episodes, you're kind of like, okay, I've had enough of this guy. He's just too aggressive, too over the top, too unlikable. And so, you know, I want to talk about that balancing act a little bit more. Neil, how was this for you? Did you find that Joel was portrayed as too soft, or did they kind of find that balance for you?
See, it's always been the case that giving you the context at the beginning of why he'd ever be like this and the way the world has gone and how cruel and cold it's become, it makes sense. And even with broad strokes, they tell that story well, even in the original game. Maybe, you know, you could say in the game, it's a bit heavy on just making him, oh, I'm really, really grumpy and gruff. And I'm like, yeah, the world, I hate everything in the world sort of thing. And yeah, it's that problem I call the John Wick problem. It's like where you're kind of trying to over explain your main character's, you know, great thing, you know, the thing about them that makes them them, rather than letting them show you. And there's a lot of that early on, you know, where you have, he's being, you know, you have Tess sort of mentioning how bad they've been and all these things they've done and people around him sort of putting the fear and hyping up the character. And then he doesn't really get to show it for a while, you know, to the level that you expect, especially when you have the context of the game character. And it really is just, I'm a bit gruff and grumpy because my daughter died 20 years ago. And it's like, fair enough, like that. And you get these little flashes, of course, which help. Again, they're always motivated by the fact that he's having a flashback to what happened, you know, stuff that doesn't really get given that context in the game later again and again. It's in such an obvious way. But the benefit of that is by being softer throughout and showing that he can come back, I think that just plays into the fear that he has, you know, and really the thing that would tip him over the edge in the first place again is to have to go through it all over again. And that's just as bad as if he'd lost Ellie. You know, it would be, you know, he would go, you know, and it's like he doesn't want to feel like that again. And I think it makes the end point for him more impactful because then, if anything, he's more vicious in the end of this than he is in the game, you know, where it's kind of like a nice even keel of things. Yeah, sure, you're going around killing things. It's just the coldness of the execution of everything he's doing. Whereas in the game, you're kind of following a game's idea of go here, do this, do that, with a little bit of it in your head going, okay, I've built up this connection with Ellie myself. There, it's like, no, it's just this cold, calculated thing of him doing it, where it's like he very selfishly thinks about, I must do this, I must do that. And yeah, I still will probably end up feeling regret and guilt for it, but at the end of the day, he's not willing to lose things again for himself. So I think that journey is more interesting the way they've done it, you know, if not maybe as consistent.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that's a pretty good way to put it. I mean, I think one thing that you touched on, and I imagine we're going to be talking about at some point, but like, I think it's harder to see that colder, darker side of Joel when you're not playing a video game where you need to kill all these people. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, obviously this show is violent, there is killing, but the way, the cold, calculated way that you kill people as Joel, I mean, if you know how to play the game, you know all the mechanics and stuff, like that paints a different picture of, maybe not a different picture of Joel, but like, that is a side of Joel that you cannot show necessarily in a TV show. I mean, it just doesn't work. So I think to that end, like I guess this is like even a greater discussion that we'll get to at some point. But I think that is probably one of my, maybe not criticisms, but one of my like low points of the show was like, yeah, there was a part of this story, this world that you just can't express in this medium. But that said, I think to your point about, you know, the Joel they've created and the Pedro and, you know, Pedro Pascal being Joel, it's like a different type of Joel that almost works better for the medium that it's in, you know. Yeah. like I love Troy Baker's portrayal of Joel, obviously, but like, I don't think if they casted Troy Baker to play Joel in this show, I don't think it would have worked nearly as
no
well.
Which I think is punctuated by his role in this, you know, when he does appear. It's the perfect character for who Troy Baker is, I think, really, in real life. You know, that's, it's very different when you're doing voice acting, where you can kind of have a bit more range. And sometimes you just don't have the aura or the face for coming across as that kind of character. So totally. He sells in this being a more cowardly, you know, sort of nasty person who's just going along with someone nastier than he would be just being like the lead guy who's doing everything himself because... Yeah, whatever. But yeah, it definitely makes sense in the live action sense of the way.
Yeah, you know, I think it was just for me within that first episode or two, you can see already, you know, that Joel is raw and, you know, the pacing, my memory of the pacing of the game might be off, but for the series itself, you know, just thinking about how almost instantly you can start to see, you know, the gaps in his armor almost that he's put up over these years, right? You start to see some more vulnerability with the fact that, you know, he's being faced with, you know, seemingly a second chance at being a guardian of a child and having to protect them, right, and whatnot. And while this is very much a job in this sense, it's the type of thing where you start to see a softer side of him almost, or some, or part of him that I suppose was not there in the game in terms of just, you know, his reactions to things and how, you know, he like lets her, she tells him off at one point, right? Especially after when Tess dies, she has that moment where she like tells him off and he kind of just folds. And, you know, perhaps that has to do with the pacing of a series, right? If you're not going to have a guy that all of a sudden like doesn't want to talk to this other character for 15 minutes or whatever while they're kind of dealing with that. But at the same time, I was just thinking how, oh, are they becoming too chummy too quickly? That was kind of in the back of my mind for the first few episodes. Granted, once you get to that place where these two characters come together and they do start to build this rapport that just grows and grows and grows to the degree that, you know, they are the Joel and Ellie that we all know and love, that is a really special moment. And it's shocking to me that they were able to have that translate to television almost as well, right? Because again, when you talk about the original game, it's one of those relationships in games that, you know, you could recommend that game to seemingly anybody that has a passing interest in video games based off of that, whether or not, you know, they're into horror or not. It's just kind of speaking to the strength and performances of those characters. And I think that also, you know, in terms of adapting it for television, the ways in which they're able to begin to incorporate small moments that then grow into, you know, pretty significant creative liberties with the source material to sort of show that parental relationship, I think is really great. And it's some subtle moments all throughout the show. Like there's one when they're camping out in the woods, right? And so she says, I believe Ellie says something to the effect of like, oh, nobody's going to find us out here, right? And Joel's like, no, nobody will come out here. And then you see that faint glimmer in his eye where he's just, where he's like, oh, well, that is a real possibility. And then you have him staying up all night as guard, right? And it's not a whole drawn out sequence or anything. It's a short bit. But again, it just kind of, it shows that sort of trust that they have in one another at that point from both sides, right? And that's something that, you know, later when he falls asleep, he chastises her for not waking him up. But then you start to see that shift in, you know, responsibilities between the two of them. But I think in terms of, you know, talking about liberties that were taken with the source material, you know, I think there's no other place to start than with episode 3, right? When you have this whole episode essentially that is focused around Bill and Frank, who are these two characters who, you know, we've only met one of them in the game, the other one we only ever heard about. And, you know, Jake, when you were on my podcast, you had hinted that you had heard, we did not go into detail on that at that point, but you did tease that episode 3 was one of these sort of monumental moments in television, right? And that I should be very excited for that. So I'd love to kind of talk about that a little more in depth now that we can. So, you know, in terms of expanding on characters far more than was actually in the source material, what was so significant about episode 3?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was where the show subverted so many expectations right out of the gate, because obviously, you know, the first two episodes, things were cut down, things were changed, some you know, dialogue was changed, they added new scenes, but that was completely different. We knew Bill was going to be in it, and we didn't, at least I did not expect the direction they were going to take at all. I mean, having that whole episode dedicated to Bill and Frank and their relationship and how it evolved over, you know, the beginning of the outbreak to the very end, I thought was super powerful, really impactful, great performances by both of them as well. But yeah, I mean, that to me was one of those moments where that kind of made me wish that the show wasn't about Joel and Ellie, because, you know, now that the show's over, now that the show's over, I'm happy that they did do that, because it was very clear that a lot of people who didn't play games, you know, would still enjoy this, and it's a special story that people should enjoy. But I think that episode alone proved that, like, there's so much more to this world that could be, with the right people, they could explore, like, some really interesting, deep, dark, exciting themes that they were able to do in that episode that was completely out of left field. I think like the one kind of disappointing thing, maybe not even disappointing, but I do kind of wish like that there was some level of interaction between Bill, Frank, and Ellie, because that also is a kind of a highlight of the game for me, is when you first go to Bill's town and you meet Bill, and him and Ellie butt heads a lot through it. Ellie makes fun of him. There's something missing there. And I don't know if that would necessarily work with the Bill they created for the show, because he seems like a gentler character, maybe, I guess you could say. Not as, I don't know, not as angry, not as bitter. but still, I was kind of hoping there'd be some sort of interactions there.
Yeah, I think the story itself, when you look back at the whole thing, is part of the bigger picture of sort of shaping these stories around Joel and Ellie to sort of help tell their story in different ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it takes the title of The Last of Us and makes it more of a general interpretation. It's not just about their story. It's about all these stories, which I think, you know, when you go into a second, third season, makes more sense when you are opening up the story to more stories and more viewpoints on this world. And I think as a device for sort of framing that for the future, it's a really good idea, because you see it again later when you have these extra characters added, or when you flesh out characters that we meet, you know, in other ways and don't make them as simple as that, then they really do just sort of begin to be more about them. And you know, that's probably why we get less of Joel and Ellie just being together doing normal stuff. And I suppose one of those divisive things is that you have these stories that aren't so much about the apocalypse, really. They aren't so much about the creatures in it. They are just about how people are enduring and surviving in this environment in different ways. And this, you know, the message of this one is that it's like, it doesn't matter, you know, love can be love and be allowed to thrive in this time, you know, when everyone's hostile in their own ways for every other reason, but you know, you can find your pocket of humanity and just live out in it, you know, happy, you know. And that's the sweet story of that little segment. So while it does, you know, fundamentally change everything about that whole Bill relationship, it does at least provide this sort of extra context for what is to come for the main characters.
Yeah, I think if they took the Bill from the game and put him in the show, I don't think any of that would have landed as well as it did in the game. Because you don't fully understand his relationship with Frank throughout that. You can kind of piece it together through notes, and like he'll make hints, but like it's not very overt. And like he's just very affronting. Like he's just he's pissed, in a bad mood, like cursing at Joel and Ellie. And I don't think that would have worked. But once again, like, I really appreciate both interpretations of this character. Like, I think both work, both serve, you know, the medium that they're in, in a way that strengthens the overall narrative significantly. I will say, I think it probably, his role strengthens, I think, the game a little more, because he has a more active role in it. But like you're saying, like, I think just to show that side of humanity is super important, especially for people who may not be familiar with the game, right? Like, I feel like when The Last of Us came out, it was like after we had a million zombie games and a bunch of post-apocalyptic games. Yeah. So like the folks picking this game up knew what they were getting into. While people watching the show, like, yeah, obviously there's tons of post-apocalyptic movies, zombie movies and stuff, but it was like an HBO show that like have they had like their sort of zombie HBO show? I don't think so.
No,
like,
and no, we just had
their apocalypse show would have been Station 11, but that doesn't have anything to do with zombies.
No, but you know, we just, you know, the Walking Dead had finished at this point by the time it's come out. You know, that's, we've seen all the things that that did, that, you know, The Last of Us did all those things as well. So it had all the humanity is the real monster nonsense. And, you know, that's a fair staple like that. So I like that they did try and show other sides to it. And, you know, they could do the, this isn't black and white thing, you know, about characters, without it being the usual thing, you know, of like, you know, everyone's, you know, even down to Joel, when you think about it, Joel was an antagonist in how many seasons of The Walking Dead in different forms? You know, he would be the governor, you know, he would be Negan in his own way. He would be one of those people who believes he's doing some greater good for some trauma he suffered in the past. And I'm glad we didn't get that character, you know, because from a lesser, you know, studio, we would have got something that was a bit more like that, and it probably wouldn't have stood out as well as it does.
Well, to take a slight deviation without leaving entirely episode three, I mean, for me, an example of what you're talking about would be the Kansas City chapters, which I think are two full episodes mm-hmm. with Kathleen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah. for me personally, those are the two weakest episodes, I think, of the season for me, because they kind of give you exactly what the type of antagonist you would expect, right? You see somebody that overthrew the government and whatnot, and they create their own sort of force. But then, of course, inevitably, they become just as bad or worse than the occupying force that was there.
Well,
and, yeah. you know, for me, I was much more, it made me appreciate episode three more because it was telling this small story that, you know, at the end of the day was not going to drastically impact their progression, you know, to getting Ellie where she needs to go. But it was telling this little microcosm of a story within this apocalyptic setting that differed from the traditional sort of power struggle. It was more about, you know, finding the thing that these people have been looking for their entire lives and, you know, how this apocalypse begins to influence it, but at the same time, it doesn't completely distort this thing that they, you know, have been looking for and finally found.
Sure. I will say on those Kansas episodes that the key thing there is that they are taking something that was very much the stereotypical, oh, here's a bunch of thugs in that are all mean and horrible and they're going to kill everyone they see, and gave it context, gave it more flesh to it, gave them a reason to be, you know, their conflict is there, and it is just an elevated version of what we've seen before in places, but it is better than what came before in that regard. It gives you more substance as a reason to, you know, Joel and Ellie aren't the victims. They're not being picked on here. They just happen to be passing through at the wrong time and connect with the wrong people, you know, and that's the way it should be. You know, I think that's a better, more subtle interpretation of what was going on, and gave them way to that whole Sam thing with the character in a way that, rather than just, oh, he's a coward in the moment sort of thing. Again, another very obvious stereotypical thing, you know, so again, giving him different reasons to be, you know, conflicted. So yeah, it's a different way of doing things.
My one amend should have been the focus on Henry and Sam was great in those episodes. Yeah. It was more so, you know, focusing on the group that springs up after Fedra's defeated and whatnot. Mm.
Yeah. I suppose in how they'll kind of quickly brushes aside, but then that's also just the nature of the story in itself and how it just sort of jumps from place to place. So, you know, you can't really focus on people that long beyond the main characters because no one really tags along for very long. You know, that's the common theme throughout the season is mm-hmm. it's John and Ellie, whoever happens to be there that week, and that's it. And then they're gone, and then you're back to John and Ellie again for a bit. And yes, it's kind of like Joel and Ellie are like the hub world of the story. You know, you'll get a lot of the times with these episodes that where they're doing something together at the beginning and the end. And then the middle stuff, it can be a lot of other characters sort of coming in and out and telling their own stories, doing their own things and sort of doing it that way. So yeah, it's a tricky thing to sort of get right, but they do pretty well, I think, in those ones.
I think one thing that I was appreciative of with the, you know, taking creative liberties with the source material was the two cold opens that we get in the first two episodes. You know, the first episode opens with that 60s talk show where you have these people having this conversation about cordyceps and, you know, how that could inevitably spread around the world and these things, which, you know, kind of parallels a COVID, global warming type discussion and whatnot. And then in the follow-up episode, it focuses on a professor of mycology in Indonesia, right? Which it sounds like is the sort of ground zero for the infection and how it spreads and everything. And I thought that those were two brilliant ways to expand on the storytelling of The Last of Us and provide greater context. But like I said, it's a cold open. Those scenes are not more than 10 minutes long. And it did such a great job of, you know, playing with the variables established in the game, but to the best of my knowledge, goes completely off script in regard to it not having any sort of basis of what was discussed in the first two or in the game. And so that was the type of thing where I was like, I really appreciated those. And I almost wish, you know, granted, episode three is just an even longer version of what I'm talking about, but I kind of wish we had almost had like one or two more cold opens like that, because at the end of the day, it provides more substance to the world without directly influencing, you know, Joel and Ellie's journey, which, in my opinion, if you're going to do an adaptation, those are the types of things that you should do if you want to give, you know, greater context that can still be approached and appreciated by both newcomers and also, you know, fans who have played through the games as many times as people like Jake and I have.
Yeah, I don't know who, I mean, it's hard to say exactly like who wrote those scenes, but those scenes feel very much like Craig Mattson's editions. Yeah. Like, because I mean, I've seen Chernobyl, and when I remember it was announced that he'd be working on it, that was one of the things I was hoping for, is what you're saying, like more context to the world, because knowing him as, you know, a showrunner, writer, director, that's kind of what he does. And to your point, yeah, I think they did it super effectively, and I would have loved to just see more.
I mean, yeah, the thing that excited me about those two cold opens, actually early on, were that they kind of gave me the stuff I liked about The Last of Us the most, which is the whole cordyceps idea, the fungus idea. And I've gone back before about the book by Harry Adam Knight called The Fungus, which, you know, goes in such detail about how this happens, you know, how they fucked with these funguses thing and it changed everything with them. And it, you know, there's so many these little mini stories in the first few chapters about people experiencing what this fungus does in different ways and how it affects them. And it's like, I love that. And I thought, oh, good, we're going to get more of that. We're going to get all this in-depth stuff about the cordyceps. And to be honest, they kind of stopped giving a shit about cordyceps after that. You know, it is beyond Ellie being not infected or someone being infected, nothing. You know, there's none. Even when you get like the appearances of different things, like the clickers or the bloaters like that, they don't really go into much thing. It's mad because on the one hand, you could probably point and go, oh, well, it must be the guy who's the showrunner who doesn't really care to put all this game stuff in, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then he's clearly the one that's put all this information at the front and said, oh, look, and presents it really well. I don't know. I don't know kind of why we left off of there. Because I don't know if we're even going to get that kind of thing happen again, you know, because where's the context really beyond introducing new types? And, you know, that'll come to a gripe out later, but, you know, it's, yeah, it was a bit of a disappointment in that regard, because I was expecting, with, you know, Mazin being involved and how insightful Chernobyl was, and then seeing all that, those cold opens, I was sure we were going to get something a bit more, you know, both sides of it, you know, just not their story, but also the building of this cordyceps infection. But, you know, they did a lot, to be fair, in those two episodes, really sort of showing you the whole process and showing you how the lead up to the outbreak, and that was really well done. And you know, but it's just, yeah, I'd like more of it.
I would definitely bet that Mazin was behind those two cold opens, because he takes that quality that made Chernobyl so chilling, you know, for that being this very grounded thing, and yet every episode of that kind of felt like a horror show in a sense, where it was just, you know, I'm thinking back to that scene when the workers have to like go dive into the water in one of those reactors, right? And how just like nerve fraying that scene is, and just how chilling when you know the implications of them being not only in the vicinity of Chernobyl, but, you know, submerging themselves in this radioactive water and whatnot, and them being oblivious to it, right? And I think that the 60s talk show segment really captures that same thing, where everybody is laughing at this doctor who is a great cameo by John Hannah, right? And everybody's laughing at him, treating him like a loon. But then over time, he wins the audience just with his words, right? He doesn't kind of become hysterical and start, you know, trying to almost like proselytize what he's talking about. He's just like very open and honest about what is going to happen later in the future and whatnot. And just to see the temperature in the room completely shift and not have to have this massive set piece moment or something like that. It's just people having a conversation. And, you know, that's true of the other cold open scene when you get to the end of the professor who's been, you know, analyzing this body that's infected with cordyceps. And basically what is her advice? She's like, there's no medicine or vaccine. Yeah. You have to start bombing cities. And then it ends with her saying she just wants to go be with her family. And again, it's not this type of moment that builds intensity through perhaps the traditional means that you might expect from a zombie series like The Walking Dead or something like that. It's just people having an open and honest and, you know, frank conversation that there is no hope. You know, the road that we're going down, it's already too late to turn back. And those were two, I think, very key moments in just setting up the series in a way that maybe made it feel different or more approachable for people that are either burnt out on zombie stuff or don't have this love for the games. But at the same time, you know, for people that do love the games, it's like, yeah, I want more of those because they were just as effective for me, even though I know eventually where this story is going. I guess also in terms of like the cordyceps and how they kind of abandon that, I thought one of the coolest things introduced in those first two episodes is the idea that the cordyceps work as like a tripwire system. Yeah. That's how the hordes communicate with one another and stuff like that. And they have to like be careful because if one of them touches something that they shouldn't, it alerts a horde nearby. Like that was such a cool new concept that's not in the game. And you get one instance of that and then they never touch upon it again. Right. And it was one of those things where I was like, how do you not return to this cool as fuck idea? That's not only terrifying and exciting for people like us that have played the games and think we know what to expect, but that is the type of curveball that you can play around with when you're taking these creative liberties.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something I was actually going to bring up because, like you, I remember that moment very clearly because I was like, okay, they're playing with it even more because, those cold opens, especially the second one, one cool thing about it is it kind of lays out like, hey, here are the differences between a regular zombie, this, and a Last of Us infected, right? And then, yeah, when they expanded on that with the, I think it was like the mycelium network or something, I was like, okay, this has to come in later, like at the end or something, but it kind of doesn't. So I'm super curious to see like what they would do with that in the future. Cause it really felt like, I don't know if there was supposed to be a scene or an episode where that may have been sort of the catalyst for something really bad. Yeah. I guess like, no, I'm thinking back to the second episode of the, what was it? Like the Pittsburgh stuff. Is it Pittsburgh? No.
Boston, I believe.
The Boston stuff, when they get cornered, that horde came because they were making a bunch of noise. So they didn't step on the network at all, right? It was just...
Well, that's how they get alerted to where they are. I think when they're at the state house, because one of them, somebody shoots one of the infected, or I just remember that a strand of it wraps around an infected, and then that alerts them, and that's what causes them to, you know, storm them, and that's when Tess dies.
It kind of nullifies the point of clickers a bit, because like they seem to work independently of the rest, and you know they have their own sort of sensor system in what they do. And, you know, it's kind of like they figured that out afterwards as well, because you know clickers really just fuck off after that. You know, it's like, but it wasn't until after where I was just sort of looking and going, oh, that's really cool they had that system, but where was it before that? You know, it's like when the clickers, you know, the noisiest fuckers of the lot are just, you know, there and not really sort of connecting with it all. Fine if they go into detail and sort of tell you the whys and the hows and stuff. And I suppose the problem with what they're doing is, you know, there aren't many people around to sort of tell you, yeah, you know, because you don't have the science there, because no one really lived long enough to tell you. So, which is one of the good things about those cold opens, you know, is that they kind of are a good foreshadowing for the end in terms of like, well, yeah, they're just saying there's no point, you know, there's no point. If we don't, there's no cure, there's no way around it. It's like, if there wasn't before when we had all the resources, what fucking chance do the Fireflies have? Yeah, that at the end. So it's, you could see how that logic might have seeped into other people's thinking over the years. Yeah, but anyway, I digress. Go back to what you said.
Yeah, you know, I guess I'll come to this now then, since I was going to save it for later. But since we mentioned it, you know, in terms of the handling overall of the infected, right? I think we always had an idea that, considering Joel and Ellie are the main drive and the main emotional core of this story, right? They are going to be the focus. It's going to provide, and I know Neil might not like what I'm about to say, but it's going to provide something that I always wanted from The Walking Dead, but never felt that I was actually getting, which was, you know, a focus on these two characters and, you know, them being either shaped or influenced by the world. But at the end of the day, it does not completely corrupt both parties. And I think that for me, I was somewhat surprised, even though, you know, HBO's involved, we know that Mazin is involved, I was surprised how little of the infected there were in this. Mm. And I'm not going to go so far as to say like it's a detriment to my enjoyment of the series and whatnot, but I will say it was definitely noticeable. And I definitely have it like on my, you know, bingo card for season two, where it's like definitely need a little bit more infected and moments around them. I mean, Jake, generally speaking, how did you feel about, you know, the handling of the infected? Did they have enough of them in the show? Did they, the scenes that did include them, you know, capitalize on just how terrifying the Last of Us's brand of infected are?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say right off the bat, like, I think the second half was pretty lacking in them. I'm not really one who cared. Like, I know a lot of people were, you know, saying it's a zombie show, why are there no zombies in it, blah, 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 blah. I think that's... That's an oversimplification. Us, right? Yeah, you kind of missed the point. I will say they did look terrifying. I loved all the scenes that they were in. I do wish there were more, but I think the thing, especially that second half, the thing to consider is like, of the game rather, the second half of that game, like the infected are more of an obstacle. They're not really like key to the story at that point. It's more like, okay, we got to get here. We got to get here. And there's 50 infected in the way that we have to get through. And, you know, you sneak past them. Like, sure, Joel and Ellie would share dialogue between each other. You'd get a little bit of backstory here and there. But I feel like there's not really a lot of plot points that deal directly with the infected after the cabin stuff with Ellie when they get swarmed at that cabin. So to me, it made sense. But... Yeah, I can see why some people are like, what happened to the infected? Like, shouldn't they be here? Shouldn't that be a threat? But yeah, I didn't think it needed them, to be honest, for that second half. I thought it made way more sense to just focus in on those characters and that immediate threat, which was, you know, the Fireflies or.
I think, Neil, you and I talked about this a little bit off air, but it was the type of thing where, you know, it's not that I felt that there was too few scenes with the infected. It's that the ones that really, you know, were supposed to be capturing just how terrifying they are, and especially when you get into the permutations, outside of the scene with the clickers, I didn't necessarily think that it captured them in the best way, if that makes sense. It kind of just felt like, well, we can't not show the infected. We can't not show the bloater or the clickers and whatnot. It didn't. And I think, if anything, it kind of showed maybe – perhaps that Mazin himself as a showrunner is not super confident with action, especially thinking about that scene when you have the bloater, right? That moment is so fleeting, and there's been a buildup now for an entire episode to the fact that there's a nest there, right? And that moment, you know, as chaotic as it is, it does have that spark of how exciting and terrifying it is at the same time, but it just felt far too almost like restrained, if that makes sense, in terms of like, it's like over in an instant. It's also the type of thing where there's not a lot of capturing little moments that really show just how visceral they are. Like, you get that brief moment where one of the little clicker childs follows Ellie into the back of a van, right? That could have been a super like intense, drawn out sequence that really captures how terrifying they are. But again, it's so fleeting. It's like a little footnote on that. It's like barely a scene that you remember. It's over so quickly. And also, like, the bloater, as heavily as that'd been advertised, it's the type of thing where I was like, okay, gets out of the pit and then he rips Perry's head in half, but you barely even see that, right? It was a moment where, if it's going to be fleeting, you need to have it be like front and center and just be this kind of like in your face moment that's unmissable before you move on to, you know, getting back to the character focused segments.
Yeah. So, you know, I agree that, you know, the second half doesn't need them as much. And I think that comes from what Craig Mazin was very explicit with before the show came out, was like, why'd they change this? Why they did this? You know, the changing the idea of it being spores because everyone would just be dead. It'd be fucked. There's no way you could do it like that. Then changing it to sort of tendrils. That made total sense. And I get that. And I suddenly thought, well, that's cool. Apply logic to things. Problem is, of course, by applying logic to things and you go to these, the back half of the season, it means you do then just go, well, you know, if we're following logic, there aren't going to be many here. You know, if you go to this zone where they've pretty much kept them under wraps for all this time, of course you're not going to see them until the end, you know, and they erupt out the ground. If you go to this sanctuary place, you know, where Tommy is, of course there aren't going to be many around. You know, if you go into the snowy wilderness, of course there aren't going to be many around in an isolated mall. you know, that is abandoned in the middle of a city. Of course not. You know, and it makes sense again and again why there wouldn't be infected there as much, if at all. But with that being said, the earlier half could have used them better and more often. Now, one of the things after watching that initial first episode that I was so excited for was, like, they show that nice tease of the towers, you know, one leaning into other, and I just thought, great, one of my favourite bits of the whole game is in the next episode, which is obviously where the clicker is originally introduced, and you have to go through those ruined buildings. I loved that section so much, and then they just skipped it, just didn't do it. And I was like, and it really rubbed me the wrong way for the rest of that episode, because I was just like, why? Like that. And then they sort of reintroduce the clicker in the later scene. And from a story context, I get why. You don't want to kind of repeat yourself twice with that, but it was annoying. And there are just several instances of that throughout those first few episodes. You know, in episode 3, you don't really get it because they changed that whole setup, so you don't get like the trap town of all that and the whole Jill upside down nonsense. And even Kansas, you know, it just keeps doing these little things, you know, that great little escape they have to get with the Sam and that, you know, tense moments that would be really good. And while I think maybe you're right to a degree, Jay, about the fact that maybe Mason doesn't really, you know, get on with action as much, I think part of it is like a bit of restraint on the budget, where they're like, we have confidence in you, but this is a video game adaptation, and we're not quite sure you can have the budget for this yet. Which is why I think they're promising more for like future seasons, because now it's like, yeah, well, we know we got back now, but they'll give us the money we want.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you see it in a lot of shows, you know, you get the first season, a bit rough and ready, does well, succeeds out of pure surprise for many of the investors and whatever. And then they're like, yeah, have the money, bigger budget for season two, like that, whatever. And it's brilliant that you'll get that. But yeah, it did feel like a mix of those two things. And you know,
yeah,
I want to see him, but yeah, it happened.
I think that kind of like feeds into one of my larger criticisms of the show, I'd say, is that I just don't... Joel and Ellie's relationship in the show felt rushed, I guess, compared to the game. And I feel like this is probably not something people who didn't play the game would notice, but I feel like, yes, it makes sense, as you're saying, to cut, you know, this scene out with the clickers that's in the game, because story-wise, there's no reason to. But part of what made their relationship so believable and so, like, their connection so strong was that, like, we still went through those places, you know? Like I fought through that room full of clickers, or I snuck by them. As Joel, I had to kill all of these people. Ellie helped me. I had to, like, you know, I had to save her from things. Maybe she saved me from stuff. And like all of that kind of feeds into this whole relationship that I feel like the show has moments and it's still heading that direction. But like, man, when I first played through The Last of Us, by the end of that game, I would have done anything for Ellie. I was with Joel, as messed up as he was, you know, and how, like, you know, how you can debate whether or not that was good. I didn't think of that. I was just like, yeah, we're doing this. But in the show, when it got to that, I don't want to quite spoil it until we get there, but when it got to that point, it just didn't feel as earned to me.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I think, as you say, a big part of that is just your own involvement has to be there. And that's why you can sort of, it's easier for people to ignore what Joel is, in a way, when you're playing the game, because you're so deeply connected with what's happening, because you are the action, you know, you are making it happen.
Yeah, you're playing an action video game, you know?
Yeah, like, yeah, and it's why, you know, in the sequel, when you have later bits, you know, that put one protagonist against another, that it's deeply uncomfortable, because it kind of pushes up against your idea of who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, like that, and, you know, which... very hard to do in games, you know, like that, and it's why it rubs people up the wrong way, which is a really effective thing to do. You know, I think, which is why a sequel needed to do it, I think. But yeah, it's not really something you can really get right with the TV show, I think, just because, unless you go longer, you know, which, to be honest, they could have. 9 episodes instead of 10, it just seems a bit odd, but...
I think I could have done with one more, maybe, in there. Like, I think after the David stuff. I think if we had one more there before the Fireflies, just to like kind of be like, because obviously that episode ends with him embracing Ellie, and then it's kind of, he calls her baby girl, like he called his daughter at the beginning. But I think maybe like one more episode just to really sell the fact that like, okay, now these two are like an inseparable pair. They love each other. They work well together. They get through this world easily because they know, not easily, but you know, they're comfortable with each other. And I feel like launching right from like the sort of apex of their relationship in the previous episode to the finale is like, whoa, hold on. I kind of wish there was something there.
Also the shortest episode of the season, right?
And I was surprised. I was really surprised.
Yeah. The reality though, I think over the course of the season, you know, the further that you get into it, it's the type of thing where it's like, okay, as good as episode 3 was, that was 90 minutes and 75 of it was dedicated to, you know, characters at the end of the day are not going to ultimately, you know, affect Ellie at least, or Joel, right? I think that when you have also the Left Behind episode, which is, again, another hour. So there's almost 2.5 hours there that don't revolve around Joel and Ellie. Again, that's not to say that they should have gone back and not done that or anything, but just thinking about like, yes, we could have definitely used another episode, because if you're taking away from those characters, you do have to keep in mind the pacing, right? And that was one of those things that, you know, I was kind of on the fence about. Is it just because it's the medium, or is it because of how they allocated time? Mm-hmm. And I definitely agree with you both in terms of you needed to have breathing room, because between that episode with David and Ellie, you know, hacking him to pieces and whatnot, to the finale, and the finale, the first 15 minutes, again, it's a flashback, right? You get that Ashley Johnson cameo that has Ellie being born and whatnot. It's the type of thing where it's like there's no breathing room at all. So it almost seems like certain moments that are so pivotal in the game, in the show, ultimately almost feel like just like poofless, right? It's the type of thing where it's like this should have had this big payoff, but it just kind of feels like a fleeting thing, which is disappointing, because when, you know, you get to the end of the game, you have these pivotal moments between characters that, yeah, sure, for people who haven't played the games, it probably landed just like it did for us the first time we played the game. But I was, again, you know, I guess shouldn't have expected them to be able to recreate the magic of the game in that instance. But, you know, when you have the moments at the end that are so pivotal, they just didn't feel like they had the same kind of payoff that it was in the game, because it was like, we're kind of just rushing through things. I think that also that leads me to probably one of the instances that I was not a big fan of at the last episode, was when Joel talks to Ellie about, oh, I was the guy that shot and missed, which I'm sure, Jake, you can correct me, but was that discussed in the game? I think that there was implications, so, but it was never outright discussed between the characters.
Yeah, I thought that was a new thing. Like, I thought they added that for the show.
Yeah, that's what I
mean,
thought.
Maybe there was some line that I missed, some brief dialogue that could have pointed to it. But yeah, that took me by surprise.
So here's the thing with that, and I could have sworn that that was new as well. But, you know, it's not that I am opposed to them including a scene like that. If anything, you know, it feels very natural for that character, right? We've seen, you know, what he had to deal with, what he survived, what he's had to done since. It's like, it's not outside the realm of possibility that he saw that as a solution at some point, right? What I was not a fan of was the fact that they introduced this new element to the character, and it is a super heavy element, right? But that conversation feels so rushed. Like, they have that conversation, and then Ellie's just like, yeah, it's like, I get that it's very awkward to be told that, but she kind of is like, yeah, well, you know, we got to get going. And then it's just over. And, you know, sure, he drops that little kind of breadcrumb. I think in the third episode, he says something about, oh, I got patched up because a guy shot and missed. But it doesn't have the payoff. If anything, it kind of just feels, I don't know, like exploitative almost of the character's trauma, kind of, because it's not given any sort of, you know, I suppose the length and discourse that a conversation like that should have between two characters, rather than just being this fleeting, like, yeah, I tried to kill myself, shit's rough, and then they just move on kind of thing.
Yeah, I would
call it should be a little more thorough than that, hopefully.
That's it. There's instances of this throughout which you could call emotional shortcuts. You know, the things where they can be all mysterious about it and just have it as a line that's almost throwaway. and it kind of bleeds into the background a bit, and you're like, somehow, if you're not really paying attention properly to everything, you're like, oh, yeah, that made sense. And then, yeah, unfortunately, if you go back again and look at everything, you're like, oh, did that need to be done that way? It didn't really work out. And just to go back to what you were saying about the rushed feeling, one of the things that really did sort of get to me in those early episodes was just when they did get to key scenes and you're waiting for them, and then they'd just be done in seconds. You know, like they'd had all this build up, and then it's like, oh, you know that scene you really like? We're going to do it in like a fifth of the time. Like
shot
that.
By shot, too.
Yeah, like that. But like someone literally skipping through the YouTube video of it like that. And it's just like, it was difficult when you had all the other things they were already cutting out to then sort of just rush through those moments as well. Like the first episode, they do such a great build up to that whole thing, you know, of what's going to happen. And then it's just done, you know, like that. And I thought, well, maybe I'm being unfair because I'm sure it's not that long in the game. It's like, no, it's definitely shorter than the game, and you have control over that. And that's, I understand why, but it was just odd. It was just odd whenever that happened, you know, and as you do lose those moments, like, you know, the implication of Ellie killing someone, you know, again, as they put it out, and that takes, you know, that has this dovetailing with the whole other story of, you know, the trust with the gun and like that, that never really happened because they changed that whole thing. There's little bits of structure that obviously, as we said, if you hadn't played the game, you're not going to miss, but it's still kind of, when you have, it kind of drives you crazy when you have these moments where you're like, that could have been there. And it's,
yeah. The build up to Joel giving Ellie a gun, like you just mentioned, I think is one of the best scenes in the game.
Yeah.
And that scene is so good because, yeah, of the build up. And this, it just like kind of happens in an episode. She's like, can I have a gun? And I think she's asked a couple times, like, yeah, sure. And then I was like, okay. I was like waiting for his like make every shot count line, because I love that scene. I think it's so good. But it was just kind of like, oh, all right. Yeah, I guess she's got a gun now. Yeah.
Even with the scene with the rifle later on, right? I think that's another huge moment in the game, right? When he goes through, you know, how to aim and all these things, like it's like a 3-second interaction in the series. Yeah. And it's when they're not in the middle of a city, you know, contending with raiders. It's just, they're out like, I don't know, shooting cans or something. And it's like, again, you know, taking moment, if you're going to recreate certain moments from the game, you have to have, it's not just that you have the interaction, but it's the context that goes with it.
Yeah.
I think also, though, at the same time, you know, for every scene that is just recreated from the game that is not done nearly as well, like I think about, oh, your watch is broken, that scene. In the game, I love the direction on that because the camera lingers on Joel and the watch as that line sinks in. But in the show, it kind of just cuts to the next thing, to the point that, you know, why would anybody that is not familiar with the game, they're not given, you know, the time to even process that line. But then at the same time, I think about the episode with Henry and Sam, when Henry has to kill him and then he turns the gun on himself. In the game, it cuts to black right away as soon as you hear the gunshot. But in the show, it lingers on Ellie's face for, you know, 3 to 4 seconds or something like that, which I think is a smart direction decision, right? That changes the game because it kind of just shows, you know, the horror of this and the fact that, oh, she has, you know, as somebody that is presenting themselves as being as strong and being weathered in this apocalypse and everything, it's like, this is still a child that is seeing these horrifying things unfold in front of them. And that was like, again, a change or an amend rather to, you know, a directorial decision from the game that I thought was a little stronger in the show. It's just unfortunate that I think there's probably more examples of, you know, taking, recreating direct moments from the game that, you can definitely start to see, you know, where they could have sort of done that better.
Yeah. As I said, I think it just tends to be about realism that sort of dashes a lot of notes, and then TV and sort of pacing for time. And I suppose the dual thing of like still kind of being in that post-COVID sort of filming period, I'd imagine, for some of it as well. And, you know, like being careful about budgets, because even HBO are going to be careful about budgets. You know, you saw that when they went back to Game of Thrones with House of the Dragon. They aren't always as bespoke as they were. So it's understandable, but it's just, yeah, these are the side effects, I suppose, of it.
I will say that I really did laugh at the magazine scene that they recreated. That definitely that captured that moment very well from the game and whatnot. But
yeah,
I guess also we haven't really mentioned it yet. What did you guys think of the Left Behind episode? They did that for an entire episode. I was kind of surprised by that. I thought it would be a series of flashbacks, or, you know, it would be half an episode or something like that. But they went a full length episode with that. How did you find they adapted that, Jake?
I thought they adapted it well. I think this kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, where there's a lot of prime real estate that was given to flashbacks and stuff. So when it got to that episode, I was kind of like, oh, okay, it's the flashback episode. Like, I know this. I know Ellie's backstory. I knew they had to do it because Ellie has that line, I think, in episode one where she mentions her friend Riley. And I was like, you wouldn't say that unless you're doing that, because that would confuse people greatly. So like, I thought it was handled well. I just didn't want it, I guess. Like, and I think once again, that is like, that is coming from someone who's played the game and knows what's going to happen and knows what has to happen for this character to make sense. So I'm just like, no, I want to see like what else they're doing with Joel and Ellie, because they have to cover a lot of ground by the end of this season. So like, yeah, like I thought it was well executed. I imagine people who hadn't seen The Last of Us was probably very effective for them, and it was very necessary. But for me, I was like, okay, let's get to next week.
I have more of an issue with the placement of it, right? Because it kind of kills the momentum, I think. When you're getting to these pivotal moments in Ellie and Joel's story, you just throw in this full-length flashback episode, which, you know, I'll say I thought it was well done. Storm Reid as Riley was terrific, I thought. It was just the placement of it and, you know, I suppose even almost too much of it, I think. I think they needed to get to the point a little bit faster, especially, again, that plays into the point at which they introduce the flashback. If it had been earlier in the season, but then I guess you would have a conflict with, like, having that too close to episode three. But at the same time, you know, just looking at the second half of the season, which, you know, really does get into the formation of their inseparable bond, right? They even have that line where it's like, wherever you go, I'll go with you after this. And again, you know, getting to that point, though, it's just like, oh, man, we're rushing through so much. We can't let anything breathe at this point. Because if you let things breathe too long, then you kill this sort of momentum that you just got done killing with a flashback kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the other thing, too, is That stuff in the game is optional, right? You can play through The Last of Us and not know Left Behind. Like, my partner loves The Last of Us, never played Left Behind until a year ago.
I think a lot of people had that were outraged about certain things in the second game. Definitely had not played Left Behind yet.
I love Left Behind. Like, that DLC, I think it's great. I think, you know, if you're going to play The Last of Us, absolutely play that afterwards. But play it afterwards. Don't stop halfway through The Last of Us, then play Left Behind, and then continue. Like, yeah, like, part of it kind of makes sense if that's how it was ordered. But like you're saying, the momentum, like, even in the game, I think would just suffer if it was like, all right, flashback. And it's like, no, Joel's going to die. Like, what's going to happen to him, you know?
Well, I will say that, you know, I kind of always wanted that to be integrated, you know, when they were talking about doing part one. I think we talked about this actually when we talked about part one, but yeah, it would be nice, because I think if you'd done it where it is flashback back to the present, it would work perfectly. And this is kind of like the monkey's paw version of that, where it's like, oh yeah, we'll put it and integrate it into the main story, but it's like, but then we'll do it the way that it probably shouldn't be done. And
yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And you know, kind of teases you at the beginning by doing what I've already said many of the episodes do, which is like, here's your hub of Joel and Ellie, and now we're going to go tell another story like that. And yeah, at that point, it was kind of obvious it was going to happen that way, but it was a bit of a tease to sort of do, here they are at the beginning, but maybe they'll dovetail it, but they don't. And you know, part of Left Behind as DLC does do that as well. So it's like, a bit annoying they didn't take that aspect of it and make it more integral. So, yeah, still we wait for the day where it sort of slots effortlessly into the story. Yeah, it's a shame in that regard, because, you know, it's the first episode I watched late, you know, of the lot. And, you know, the thing is, you know, I've only played the DLC once. Because I think the first time I ever played it crashed like four times for me, for some reason, which is more than the game ever did. But yeah, it was, you know, I knew the story, great, lovely, and just always kind of hoped that it would just be part of the main story. But here we are. It didn't quite happen what we wanted.
Yeah.
Well, I think that that's a lesson that hopefully they will learn or be cognizant of in how they choose to adapt season two or game two for season two, right? Because I think some people are worried, oh, we're going to get season two that opens with the way that part two opens, which my money's on that's not how they're going to open season two. I think that in terms of an adaptation, not only do they want to hold on to Pedro Pascal as long as possible, but it's the type of thing where, you know, they're taking these creative liberties. So I would hope that they're going to, I believe the town's called Jackson that they're in, but like fleshing Jackson out is more of this microcosm of like a success, the best case scenario for this worst case scenario that the world is in, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe fleshing that out even more so, and then sprinkling in moments either, you know, that occurred at the end of season one in terms of like what happened immediately after throughout the season. You know, they have a lot of freedom and they've proven that, right? With something like episode three, where they just go completely off script, off of the barest of bones of something that's implied in the game. And I'm hoping with season two, it's the type of thing where they either flesh out the game to the degree that, oh, you can get half season before Joel's fate, or at the same time, perhaps his fate occurs sooner than that, but they have a series of flashbacks that analyzes his relationship with Ellie. It's the type of thing that, you know, as much as I enjoyed season one, I'm even more excited for season two, not just to get to, you know, maybe more infected or something like that, or moments that I really enjoyed in the game, but more so just to see how off script they can go with a game that I think one of the common criticisms of it was the fact that, you know, it takes this kind of hard left turn at the mark when you go over to Abby, right? And seeing how maybe getting a second attempt at telling this story from two POVs, how they can kind of play around with that creatively speaking.
Yeah.
I think that's what has me most excited.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about that that's going to be interesting in that I always hoped that when they did, if they were going to announce any more, that they wouldn't just make one more season and rush for it, because, you know, it's twice as long for a start.
Yeah.
So to hear them say they're going to do more than one season of it, you know, or sort of allude to that, I was like, that's good, because you really need to take your time with this story.
Yeah. A lot of characters too that I'd argue weren't even entirely fleshed out in the game that
This is what I said earlier, you know, like I like that they've set that up now with this first season, of the idea that The Last of Us isn't just about those two but about the wider effect of their actions and other characters around them, and we got that already, so we that's something to be confident about, I think, going forward, so we will have that in place for any future episodes. How you sort of divide that story to tell it that way is going to be interesting, because, yeah, I think the way they've been doing things so far means that you'd have a lot less justification for disliking Abby or hating Abby in the same way when you are basically getting the same kind of story told. You know, like, you know, there's a reason behind this, there's a reason to do this. And it makes sense. Yeah. Obviously, when in the game, you are pretty much presented with it as a, well, we don't know who you from Adam, you know, and that's it. It's not till later you get the context, you know, and there are many people that don't like that rug pull, but it's still just so powerful, I think, as a thing, you know, as a way to do things. And it does just come down to how you feel about Joel, you know, and, you know, how you understood what Joel did and how there had to be consequences for that, you know, and it's just you don't get to understand straight away. So maybe a bit better balance in sort of trying to get that across earlier. I think even Neil Druckmann might feel that way now, to go, well, you know, maybe we could have just given a bit more context earlier on. You know, I mean, some of that was down to the leaks not helping, but still. There's definitely room for improvement in sort of delivering that story.
Yeah, you know, taking their time with those characters too, because that's probably one of my main complaints about season one, is just the fact that, you know, I thought that the casting overall for a majority of the secondary characters was really well done.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you have Gabriel Luna as Tommy, who, you know, I think we get two episodes with him and it's only like a scene in each episode. You know, Melanie Lynskey, I thought was, you know, Melanie Lynskey, who's great in Yellow Jackets, but again, you know, the time with that character is so fleeting that by the time that character meets their fate, it feels like, oh, we were just sort of like getting to know this person.
And on that, sorry, just to say, yeah. On the fate of that character, that was the most hokey shit in the whole show. I'm sorry, it felt like it had come in from a much lesser show. It is like, yeah. Oh, the bad guy's going to get this obvious comeuppance from this sort of, you know, Chekhov's gun of a zombie creature that we've introduced. And it's like, I didn't like that part of it. You know, that made it feel worthless more than anything else.
Well, yeah, I think also the scene that comes just before that character's fate is the one where she starts to kind of like actually reveal that her humanity, right? She has that heart to heart with Perry and whatnot, yeah. Who Perry notably is the voice of Tommy.
Yeah,
actually Jeffrey in the game, Pierce. Which is pretty Jeffrey cool. Pierce. But again, like a character that, you know, again, he's just a bodyguard, but at the same time, like just spending one more scene showing why this is her guy, right? Mm-hmm. I think little moments like could just be a single scene, but just something that gives more validity to why, you know, we've even attached a name to this character. But I thought also, you know, for Tess, Anna Torv, who is fantastic in Mindhunter, I thought was great as well. And it was the thing where I was like, oh man, if I could just use one more scene with her before they leave the Boston QZ or something like that. Or it was, you know, the type of thing where, and Jake, we even talked about this with the premiere where, or the pilot episode, where it was the type of thing where I was like, are they rushing to get out of the QZ just to get this journey started? And the longer that I was rewatching the season, I was like, I could have used at least, you know, another half episode of them in the QZ, I think, just because I want to flesh out that world more. I want the impactfulness of a character like Tess not to be lost on anybody that, you know, is not familiar with the games and whatnot. And granted, in episode 3 with the letter that Bill leaves Joel, like, yeah, sure, that's kind of like reinforcing the fact that, oh, this was somebody that was important in his life that had this impact. Mm-hmm. But I just needed more moments like that, I think, throughout. But yeah, I guess in terms of season 2, like what I was most relieved to read was they have not even considered recasting Bella Ramsey as Ellie, which was kind of a, I think there were some faint murmurings whether that was going to happen before this season wrapped. But they have confirmed that they will not be recasting, which is great, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, she is that age, you know, that Ellie is in the sequel anyway. And they do make a very deliberate choice to sort of de-age her character in terms of how she dresses and, you know, her physical appearance and stuff like that. So there's little subtle things about it that make her appear younger than she is like that. And is that, you know, she's at an age where that, you know, you are changing so much anyway as a person, you know, physically that it's quite easy to, you know, if you film a couple of years later, you are going to look fundamentally different at that age. So I think that won't be a problem. And she's just so believable anyway in terms of how she could go there. And I like the little sort of seeds they've planted along the way in this season, just showing that she could become that Ellie so easily. You know, like that. It's, you don't need someone else to do it. It would just derail everything. So yeah, I'm glad. I'm very glad that that's the case. They probably got her to be in this at just the right time, I think, in that regard, because yeah, she's going through the journey in that way at the same time. I like that.
But yeah, you know, I think that it was one of those things that made me laugh too, because I was reading some comments. It was just like, well, you know, is she going to be able to look the part for an older Ellie? And it was like, they de-age people all the time, or they make people look older than they are all the time. Yeah. Anyways, with prosthetics and all this stuff and makeup and whatnot, it was like, why is that even part of the conversation? But I guess before we wrap up, Jake, were there any other elements of season 1 that you thought were particularly notable in either adapting or just moments that you thought did the source material justice?
I feel like we covered a lot of the big stuff. One thing we didn't touch on, though, I thought was Tess's death. And that was changed in many ways, right? Mm. I mean, it was infected instead that killed her. There was that weird kiss thing that I know a lot of people had issue with, which kind of came out of left field. Like, I was a little surprised by it, yeah. But I guess was enough to buy into it. I was like, all right, well, I guess that's how it is. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else there is to necessarily say about that scene, but that scene definitely stood out for me. And I'm not really sure if it's because I liked it or I didn't. And I think part of it might be to what you were saying earlier, where I just wish there was a little more Tess before we lose Tess, you know? And, you know, I kind of hinted at it a little bit, but like one of my concerns with season two or season two and three of, you know, whatever Last of Us Part Two covers, is that, like, I think one of the reasons why some people had an issue with, including myself, with, like, some of the events of two, was that, like, I didn't particularly care for any of Abby's sort of friend group, you know, social structure, like I did with Ellie. And I really hope that, you know, in the show, they are able to really flesh out all these characters. And there's a lot more characters, and characters that aren't just there to kind of show up and be with Joel and Ellie a little bit and then die or disappear, whatever it might be. Yeah. Like, they're super important, because, you know, once again, to your point, it is about the ramifications, how their actions affect a bunch of people, not just one person. Yeah. And I think if they treat a lot of these side characters the same way they treated side characters in this, I think there might be a concern. Now, not every side character, right? Like, I just talked about how much I love the Bill episode and stuff, but, like, I just hope these other characters get enough for people to chew on, so they can kind of accept, I guess, some of the actions that happen in two.
Yeah. It would be amazing if they could make me care about a character like Owen.
Exactly.
You know, like, right? Characters like that, where I'm just like, you get to the end of two and I'm just like, wow, that was a whole lot of time with people I am not invested in at all.
And like, I really liked Abby. I thought Abby was a great character. Yeah. So I was like sold to that point. Yeah. It was just like, but then it went to Ellie and it's like, okay, I love like all of Ellie's friends and what they did, even some of them in the game, I wish they kind of got a little more, but like Dina and I don't know. I don't want to spend too much time talking about two, but
yeah,
I guess that's kind of one of my concerns, improvements. So I really hope they end up doing like what you're saying, that it'll be two seasons. They'll spend all the time they need, and maybe they think about that structure, because the way that game is structured, I feel like there's a lot of room for reinterpretation on just the fundamental plot of that game. Not necessarily changing how it happens, but just like, okay, maybe we could, you know, front load this stuff with like what would be flashbacks, but we'll start with like, you know, Joel and Ellie here getting over it. Or maybe you can start as far back as that scene with Abby as a kid, or maybe you just start on Abby. You know, there's so many different approaches that I think TV might actually have a better chance of pulling off than the game.
Yeah.
But that remains to be seen, because like, even, you know, Neil, you mentioned how like part of the reason why that fight between Ellie and Abby is so impactful is because you're uncomfortable. You don't really know who the hero or isn't, you know, at that point. And like, how do you do that in a show? I don't know. I'm excited though. I'm really excited.
Yeah. I think one of the main things you're going to have there that's quite interesting is that whole duality of it. It's like, you are telling the same story. You know, it's the MGS2 thing. You're telling the same story again, but from a different perspective, you know, like that, and sort of having it all sort of eat itself, you know, as you have everyone playing out someone else's role throughout, you know. You know, Abby is doing the revenge role, then Ellie's doing the revenge role, and, you know, it's like, and then the Abby and Lev stuff is basically, you know, a callback to the stuff we've already had with Joel and Ellie, and it just keeps going round and round and round, and then completes itself in a perfect circle. So I'd love that they can find a way to do that. And the way we set up so far, to me, suggests that they are thinking of that, you know, already. So I'm really confident of that. And I think, of the stories, it is the one that is better suited to be adapted to television, because I think the ambition's there. I just think it was a bit messy for a video game at times. And
agree.
Yeah. So, but I like messy. I like things that are ambitious and messy and don't always pull it off, because there's always something more interesting about them, you know. And the first game has been discussed to death in terms of what it does well and like the beats it goes well. And that's where it fundamentally falters sometimes as a TV series, because you are kind of waiting for those beats and going, well, why didn't they do this like this? Or why didn't they do it like that? And like, not so many arguments to be had, I think, with the second game, where you can just sort of maybe riff on it a bit more and change things about a bit and be a bit more confident in it, because there's no wide consensus to play to, you know? I think that you are going to get people that are going to hate it either way. There are people that love it either way. And so just, keep firing the way you've been firing. You've established your own timeline effectively of how to do things and styles. So yeah. And with a bigger budget that I'd imagine they'll get, you know, sky is the limit.
They'll probably need for that season.
Yes. Oh, man. And as long as we get the Rat King, absolutely yeah. fine. And he isn't just like a 2 second bit.
Could you imagine if they cut that out? Good God. Yeah. But it is the type of thing where I'm going into a second season incredibly excited to see not so much if they're going to rewrite things, but how they can reshuffle things, kind of like what we've been saying in terms of just making it a bit more cohesive or giving it the breathing room that it's so badly needed, I think, even though, you know, I definitely enjoy part two as well. But Jake, as always, man, we appreciate you coming on to chat, you know, games in general, shows in general, but specifically The Last of Us as well. So thank you again, man, for your time. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was a blast. I love hanging out with you guys and especially, you know, talking about Last of Us.
Fantastic.
Maybe we'll have you on to chat about something else in the future. But if not, we'll definitely come back to you for your Last of Us knowledge.
I'm always here.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Safe Room. If you enjoy the show, please rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Safe Room Pod for show updates. You can also drop us an email over at saferoompod@gmail.com if you'd like to share your thoughts on a game we're going to cover. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you guys next Monday.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.